The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
All right, everyone, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. And for those of you who are new to the program, this is a series of radio broadcasts and talks that I give that defend and explicate the both the Russian and the Ukrainian Orthodox tradition, especially for those of us of Western background who are approaching this for the first time. And but we don't deal with that in isolation. We deal with that, as has always been dealt with, as inherently present in the social and political struggles of our age. And that can only be reduced to the resistance to globalization and the New World Order ideology that goes along with it. And it's always been my view that the Orthodox world, particularly the at least the present government of the Russian Federation, is our best bet right now against the forces of globalization. I heard from my old friend at the American Free Press, Jim Tucker, that at this last Bilderberg gathering, and I actually found the list of members who were invited to this thing, and it was published in the American Free Press, and I was struck by the fact that not a single Russian was invited. And I think that's the first time that that's ever occurred. So clearly, at least from the Bilderberg point of view, Russia is the enemy and is going to be excluded from their development of the New World Order and its in the fashionable ideology that undergirds it. But I like to deal with really my favorite topic and the topic to which I've dedicated my life as a historian, the relations between Russia and Ukraine, specifically relations between Russia and Ukraine relative to the battle against the New World Order. And I have taken the position that was held most famously by Nikolai Gogol, a famous Ukrainian author who I've dealt with on this program. And his point of view was that Ukraine's future is with the East. It's with an alliance with Russia and Central Asia, and that while Ukrainians and Russians are two distinct people, they're bound together by a common Orthodox faith. So I think ultimately Gogol's point of view was that Ukraine should be an independent part of a larger pan-Orthodox global movement. Especially later in his career, that was his general point of view. So while I love and respect the achievements of the old Russian Empire and the Russians in the diaspora, my heart remains with the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, and especially its doctrine of Sabunoprawna, which we've also dealt with on this show, and all Ukrainian Orthodox factions and movements, no matter who they're under, are based on, at least in theory, the doctrine of Sabunoprawna. And myself, my clerical status derives most recently from the patriarchs of Kiev, specifically Mstislav and Vladimir. I've dealt with Mstislav on this program. Vladimir, I have an article on him. As far as I know, the only attempt to understand him politically in the English language on my program page here at the Voice of Reason. We do not recognize, for a whole host of reasons, the current Patriarch of Kiev, Filaret. in my personal opinion, Fillerette is a fraud. But even if he is not, he is certainly a liberal ecumenist who looks to the West and the Uniates these days for support against Russia in Ukrainian space. Anyway, today we're going to deal with a topic that's very, very close to Ukrainian studies. And that is the world of the Baroque and the Rococo styles of art and architecture and literature that came into Ukraine via Poland after the Renaissance, far after the Renaissance, as far as Eastern Europe is concerned. And it came in under the hetmanate of Ivan Mazepa. And we've dealt with Ivan on this show. And so the fact that Ukraine had a substantial Baroque period and that the Baroque took root in the Ukrainian world, it's one of the Ukrainian claims for independence and distinctiveness against Russia. Russia had a minor Baroque period, but it really came almost exclusively from Ukraine. Under Peter the Great, who, as I've said many times on this show, was not a legitimate czar. I don't believe that his successor was. I don't believe that Catherine the Second was. I think the 18th century was very, very dark for Russia and really for most of the world. And so much of the older Russian tradition existed in Ukraine, Belarus, and also among the old believers. But Peter's artistic interest was strictly neoclassical because he wanted to reorganize Russia on the old pagan Roman standard, not the Eastern Byzantine Orthodox standard, but the old pagan Roman standard. And that really was his worldview. So he kind of skipped any concept of Baroque or Rococo or Romanticism, and he went straight for the really artificial imposition of the neoclassical world, especially in the creation of St. Petersburg. And when Peter moved the capital from Moscow to St. Petersburg, the old Russian title used to be just Muscovy. This was the Kingdom of Muscovy. That's what it was universally known as. That was not meant as a diminutive. It simply was what it was. But it didn't make any sense to call it Muscovy anymore when Peter moved the capital to St. Petersburg, and therefore it became Russia. And I want to make another statement before we start on this topic, and that the word Russia is a contested word. It's a complicated word. The concept of Russia is, and again, I rely on Gogol in this respect. The idea of Russia is very expansive. It doesn't just refer to those people living within the confines of the Russian Federation. It refers to Ukrainians. It refers to Belarusians. It refers to Carpathorussians. It refers to the Lemko in Poland. It refers to the Russians and all of these other people in the diaspora. It refers to all Rus Slavic peoples, wherever they might be. And they all have a claim to the title of Russia, not just those surrounding the old city of Moscow. And so that's another way I think that we could begin to make peace between two, distinct and yet fraternal and related peoples. The Ukrainians and Russians understand that they all have the right to the name Russian, and it makes sense in all of those contexts. Ukraine has a right to independence. It has a right to its own patriarchate and its own church based on specifically Ukrainian principles. There is nothing wrong or problematic about that. Where I differ, at least with some Ukrainian nationalists in the diaspora, is that I think that there should be a general a cooperation and partnership between Ukraine and Russia, specifically within the Shanghai Trade Organization, which is sort of the Eurasianist trade movement and will become one of the dominant trade organizations in the world. I see no real reason why Ukraine or Poland or the Balkan states should attach themselves to what is clearly a decaying, a completely bankrupt, literally and metaphorically, Western European world and American world. Their time is over, and their time was quite destructive to the world, as World War I and World War II show. And the bankruptcy, both ideologically and financially, of the Western world really shows that there is no sense economically for Russia or Ukraine or anyone else coming out of the communist tyranny to turn to the West whatsoever. The future is in the East, and that's proven not just in terms of population growth and everything else, but also in terms of actual dollars and cents. Now, in Ukraine, the Ukrainian nationalist movement is not as anti-Russian, anti-Moscow, as you find in the diaspora. Even in central and even in western Ukraine, you do have. I mean, while no one wants to give away Ukrainian independence, even in the east, there is a generally positive view of Russia, at least from the point of view of economics. And Putin's success and Lukashenko's success, economically speaking, is very impressive to a Ukraine that really right now, although it's a potentially very wealthy country, it has an educated, hardworking population, is really now at third world status, while Russia and Belarus are now at first world status. So this is a problem for those who want to attach Ukraine to a bankrupt and deeply corrupt and evil Western Europe. Okay, this show is really about the Baroque culture that developed in Ukraine during the time of Hetman Mazepa. And as I said before, you have a Ukrainian nationalist view, very proud of the Slavic Orthodox heritage of Ukraine, but also seeing Ukraine as a partner with Germany and Austria in Central Europe. Not necessarily wanting to attach itself to the West or to America, but seeing Ukraine as a natural partner of Germany and possibly being able to play Germany and Russia off against each other for the benefit of the country. That Ukraine is a Central European country, and this is proven by the fact that, among many other things, it had a very powerful Baroque period. What was the Baroque? When the paper came out in 1970, the Baroque and its impact after 1550 by Miroslav Hynek. And he defines the Baroque largely as this Weltgeist, this world vision, this world spirit that's an exaggerated and explosive, almost an unnatural explosive emotionalism. It's a rejection of perfectibility. It's an attack on the Renaissance and Enlightenment, even though it comes into existence at the same time. And there's another, as the Enlightenment, there's another paper called The Baroque Versus the Enlightenment, that the Baroque is a method of life, a method of thinking, a method of acting that manifests itself in things like art and architecture and literature and even liturgy that is based around the idea of dynamism and motion, this restlessness, problems that derive from the complete lack of there's been the promises of both the Enlightenment and the earlier Renaissance have gone unfulfilled. The perfectibility and the domination over nature that the Enlightenment has made this the core of its existence, none of that really materialized. And so the rejection of the Renaissance that we saw and we heard in my talk on Savonarola a few months ago, a lot of that mentality, this return to God, a return to the soil, and that's very specific in the Rococo later on, that this is at the very heart of the Baroque. It's based around, as Hynek would say, broken promises of the early Enlightenment. The main Baroque issue in all of its manifestations is this constant battle between flesh and spirit. The Enlightenment often rejecting the very idea of spirit couldn't solve the problem. By simply sweeping spirit under the rug, it could not take away human freedom. Because if you're a materialist, you can't believe in freedom by definition. So what the Baroque is doing is trying to unify the legitimate insights into natural law from the Enlightenment period with the ancient tradition of, in this case, the Ukrainian and the Polish people. Instead of viewing matter as just this dead entity, it sees logos in spirit embodied in matter. It sees the spirit as animating matter. It, for a better word might be, it sublimates matter to spirit. You need to remember, as the Baroque develops in the early and middle Enlightenment, you have the emergence of the centralized state and materialism, the emergence of what we can call real totalitarianism, because only in the Enlightenment can a totalitarian world develop, because only then does the technology and the communications that the state needs and the economy needs to control people develops. The decline of the Italian cities as the absolute, and I could even say the slow decline of, well, the slow decline of the Italian cities relative to Northern Europe, the Counter-Reformation, and the redevelopment of Western theology in response to both Anglicanism and Protestantism. And then this constant problem, this confrontation between René Descartes and Thomas Hobbes. You know, Descartes had maintained the existence of spirit. Hobbes had maintained only the existence of matter. And this was not being solved at the time of the Baroque. The Baroque was a way to try to unify matter and spirit. In 1946, a paper came out in the Journal of Aesthetics and Art Criticism by William Fleming on the concept of motion in Baroque art. And the centerpiece in his world of the Baroque order is that progress and motion exist, they are eternal, but they can exist only within the moral order based upon natural law. And what he says is that, you know, the neoclassical view was this kind of stoic serenity and repose, but the Baroque view was almost its opposite: striving, becoming, struggling. It was a method of saving the spirit from these things, like the development of capitalism, oligarchy, the state, mass armies, mass warfare, to save the human spirit from these things that were attacking the human spirit. Science was claiming that all things can be brought under its control, including human action. The Baroque was a reaction against that. It saw things like the development of the clock, the development of the machine, in a very complicated sense, as proto-totalitarian. And it wants to save the realm of the spirit by holding that logos exists within it. Logos is something that could take matter that was pronounced dead by the Enlightenment and only could be manipulated and controlled by the scientific elite, and said, no, it is not dead, it is infused by logos, and we can talk about the manifestation of logos in matter through talk about natural law. And so these people are looking at Galileo, they're looking at Newton, they're looking at Descartes, and they see a very, very deep insight here, that the one thing that we know about nature is that it's always moving, it's always striving, it's always restless. But it doesn't do these things arbitrarily. It does these things according to law. That means that at the moment of creation of matter, the lawfulness of material relations had to exist. That means matter and law had to have been created at the same time, or nothing makes any sense. Therefore, God, a creator, must exist, because lawfulness is the one thing other than motion that we know about material relations. Lawfulness is an immaterial reality. It's a series of connections that's manifested in the motion of objects. So the Baroque, in its Orthodox manifestation in Ukraine, is not in the least worried about people like Isaac Newton. It sees verification in people like Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton, certainly far from a materialist and an atheist, far from it. Isaac Newton was obsessed with the idea of lawfulness being intrinsic to matter. Therefore, matter cannot be dead in the way that Thomas Hobbes had had theorized. The neoclassic horizontal line gives way in Baroque architecture and art to diagonals and curves. It's light and shade versus color. And you see light and shade as symbols of secrecy, symbols of the unconscious, symbols of that constant striving that can't be quantified by the sciences. And in Baroque art, you see this obsession with light and shade relative to color, and that light and shade being one of the many symbols within the very deeply symbolic world of the Baroque thinking. Display, pomp, these things matter more than comfort. You see in a lot of Baroque buildings and really in landscaping, fountains and pools, it's this, they always want to remind you of this non-quantifiable entity that exists in nature, and that is our will, that is our struggle, that is our emotion. Something that develops in Baroque music and liturgy is the world of the solo. Solo is something philosophically very significant, because it is the unity, put it this way, it is the one that manifests itself, however briefly, out of the many. It is the unity that can be found within dissension. The one, our individuality does exist, and the solo proves that it exists. But it exists only within the context of the culture, of the many, of the world of the society at the time. These things are symbols, and symbols in the Baroque tell us about the infinity of the human will. We can continuously decode and get deeper into symbol upon symbol upon symbol. And the idea of the symbol is that it expresses something relatively simply, and that something that's expressed is infinitely deep. It's the return of the Platonic form. It's the return of the moral order from the attack and the destruction of the Enlightenment. All right, we'll be right back.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
All right, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalists. We're dealing with the Baroque and the Rococo in Ukrainian culture and dealing with what these things really are, not just as art forms, but also as mentalities. And a lot of people hold that the Rococo essentially is nothing more than the late Baroque, and I think there's something to that. The paper came out in 1960 called The Rococo as a Dream of Happiness. And the Rococo wants to move away from the gaudy intensity of the Baroque, and it's a ruralist movement. It has the same philosophical background as the Rococo, but it's a little bit tired of the constant motion and striving, and wants to find some kind of happiness. Or maybe I shouldn't even say happiness. I should say contentment within nature. That nature contains the same deep symbols as the architecture of the Baroque. And it really centers around the search for some kind of contentment over the social and political duties that have now been put on people, given the rise of the centralized state, especially in Western Europe. It's a renunciation of power in exchange for beauty and contentment. The Baroque spoke of a great truth. It spoke of the restlessness of all human striving, and ultimately the lack of any limit. The limitless of human desire, that our desires can never really be satisfied in any kind of permanent way, and therefore our response must be a return to nature, a renunciation of power and the state, the renunciation of the urban and a return to the rural. This kind of skeptical and very insecure aristocracy wants to return to its ancestral estate. Happiness and contentment do not require power. In fact, power and happiness are opposites in many ways. It's a townhouse architecture. It's a little bit less gaudy, but it's smaller and intimate. The mentality is very much the same, but they love the idea of an intimate gathering rather than some larger world of mass society. A mass society is something that's just developing, as the Middle Ages is clearly something now, a thing of the past. The aesthetic and intellectual pleasures become this now alienated aristocratic concern. The cult of woman is something that develops in this period of time. The woman as domestic, the woman as something outside of mass society and the state, and that makes her something pure. It makes her something worth pursuing, because it's men who control the state. It's men who control the economy. This is not a good thing because of the massification of society, of the oligarchy that now controls the state. Woman is now the symbol of that domestic repose that is at the basis of the Rococo. So what you have is, as the Baroque is struggling with the idea of centralization, the Rococo has largely rejected the idea of centralization. And it really celebrates the idea of the subgroup. Groups of literate people, groups of aristocrats in an intimate setting, lots of darker colors, dark reds, maroons, these kind of things that give, you know, the low ceiling, you know, these things that give the sense of intimacy and devotion away from centralized mass society. And so the domestic world of woman is not some terrible thing. The domestic world of woman is the only salvation of humanity. And I want to make it clear that prior to the rise of Jewish feminism in America, and feminism is almost exclusively a Jewish phenomenon, woman was the guardian of the hearth. Woman was the guardian of the tradition. Woman was the center of the Orthodox home, or the Catholic home in places like Poland. The domesticity of woman was not something to be overcome, just the opposite. It was something to be envied by the men who were dying in fairly large numbers in the warfare state that developed in the late Renaissance. Now, in 1972, a paper came out called The Baroque in Russian Literature, and really what they mean is both Russian and Ukrainian literature. And it's written by a Jay Busela in Russian Review. And, you know, it says a lot of the same things, but brings it to both a Russian and Ukrainian context. And it's, first of all, it's like both the Baroque and the Rococo, it's a manifestation of an alienated aristocracy, an aristocracy that realizes its literary superiority to the masses, and yet is being removed from power as the centralized state requires sort of these middle class clerks in order to function. The oligarchic economy, the centralized state, the warfare state, these are the very opposites of the rural agrarian aristocratic mentality. The massed ballroom rituals are developing in this era that show that really manifest the artificiality of mass society behaviors. It's the artificiality of so-called civilized society. These guys like the idea of surprise and shock, which necessarily goes along with the eternal movement of nature, that the inner passions become exaggerated, and you see this kind of grotesque piling up of words and rhetoric, symbol upon symbol, that then manifests another symbol. It shows a complexity within unity, a unity of the ethnostate, especially in Ukraine, but this unity really masks a complexity, a series of subgroups, each with its own particular interest, and this really makes sense for the aristocracy that sees its power moving away. The aristocracy is deeply alienated from Peter's reforms and the centralized state that's developed throughout Europe. And so this complexity within the unity is what's promoted, because the complexity serves the interests of those aristocrats who want to maintain their subgroup unity, if not above the state, at least alongside it, and possibly opposed to it. And I think to some extent the Slavophile movement takes a little bit from this. But the aristocracy is beginning to look at the oligarchic economy and the centralized state as really showing to the world the vanity of political power, the eternal cult of death, and certainly Petersburg brought that into the Russian world. Quite literally, Petersburg is built on top of the bones of the Ukrainians who were forced to build it. After the defeat of Mazepa, the Cossacks were enslaved by Peter the First, Peter the Great, brought to St. Petersburg into the freezing cold and forced to essentially dig the foundation of the cities, of the city itself, and they died in very large numbers. Their bodies were then dumped into the foundations of the buildings that were later to be called St. Petersburg. That is, for those of you who know the occult, that is a deep, dark Gnostic symbol of the death of the free Cossack, the death of the free man, the death of a real aristocrat in the true best sense of the word, and mass society and the state will be built on top of their bones. Peter the Great, he was a Freemason, he was initiated into the lodge in Amsterdam. He knew the basic occult ideology and made it the center of his rule. And the fact that Peter the Great was a demonist, at least in a very general sense, a Promethean, for lack of a better word, became really the central vision of the Old Believers in their opposition to Peter, as well as a developing Ukrainian national consciousness and Orthodox consciousness against Peter the Great. And then the ideology of Thomas Hobbes, not too surprising, was imported through the work of people like Feofan Prokopovich and others to support and justify the rule of Peter. One of the manifestations of the Baroque is the life of Avakum, the leader and founder, essentially theologian of the Old Believer movement, and his autobiography, which, by the way, I strongly recommend you read. It's fairly brief, and it's really nothing but a catalog of how just barely pre-Petrine state, the modernizing state of the very late Alexis, and even the beginning of the oligarchy of Sophia, how he was tortured, how he was sent into exile, and yet he died within the old faith, not the new faith that was being promoted by the proto-Petrine state. It was a victory over heresy that derives from constant struggle, constant motion, constant a battle, and yet still with a singleness of purpose. And this is manifest in natural law, because you see this with nature itself. There is a singleness of law that you could find within the movement and development of natural things, and so there is that diversity in unity. There is a solo that's taken out of the orchestra briefly, isolated for a short time, and then comes back into the unity. So you can see to some extent why the Baroque was taken by the aristocracy, why it was, even in its later Rococo development, taken by the aristocracy in certain Orthodox movements, both in Ukraine and in Russia itself under the Old Believers, and made something very, very important to them, the very foundation of their existence. Again, speaking very generally, this is a general way of thought rather than a specific painting, a specific building. This is a way of life. But as always, the central fundament of everything that these people do is that God is immanent in nature. He is not identical with nature, but he is immanent in nature via the Son, via the Logos. And that is the basis of all natural development, because the law of natural development has to exist codeterminous with the creation of matter in the first place. Law cannot be the subject of evolution. Natural law can never be the subject of evolution, because it is a condition for evolution. And it's something that should have evolutionists scratch their heads a little bit, because they have to explain where lawfulness, as this regularity, came from. It has to exist at least at the same time that matter exists, if not beforehand. So I want to conclude this discussion on the Baroque in general, but more specifically as it developed in Ukraine, with a few statements made by a writer in a paper called The Enlightenment Versus the Baroque. And to some extent, the Enlightenment mentality, I think best expressed by the Royal Society and the Lunar Society in Great Britain, as well as the synagogues of Northern Europe and Central Eastern Europe, They saw economics as something that should be superior to politics, that the state, in fact, is something tightly integrated with the economic regime, and that society is a tabula rasa. Society is a blank sheet of paper that the system can then impose itself upon. And that's the case with matter. Matter has to be just this dead lump of nothing that then the elite, the state, the economy, the royal society, the universities, whatever, can then create their new world out of. And ultimately, that becomes the golem in the both the Talmudic and the Kabbalistic sense, that can be used to destroy the old society, i.e., Christian society. And you know, the attack of the Enlightenment on the nobility was very serious, because the nobility viewed themselves as the guardians of what might we could call now the Rococo order. The idea of repose and happiness to be found in simplicity, in nature, and in an acceptance and devotion of its ever-flowing, ever-developing logos or lawfulness. But the developing regime in the West, a regime that we still are forced to live under, based itself on the idea that the nobility was parasitic, and yet the banker and the state, these were productive entities that now could bring us to a world of peace and plenty. And of course, those promises were fraudulent from the very beginning. That the individual mattered, not the family, not the estate, not the parish, not the monastery. No, the individual mattered. It's hard to control estates. It's very easy to control isolated individuals. And the Enlightenment hated the Baroque. The Baroque was generally pessimistic. And that man could be happy if and only if he followed his own self-interest. So, the main issue here is that the Enlightenment took aim at the Baroque mentality. Capitalism took aim. The state took aim at the Baroque mentality, because the Baroque develops as a worldview that wants to guard the willfulness and the loves of human beings ultimately as something that cannot be measured, of infinite depth, that sees God not as some cartoon character floating in the sky, but sees God as imminent and manifest, although not identical with nature. God, through via logos, or the sun, exists within natural objects and is their lawful relations. Those lawful relations had to exist prior, or at least at the same time, as created nature. Since, as Newton and Galileo would argue, that these natural laws are codeterminous and inherent in natural objects. And that was something that was vehemently argued against Thomas Hobbes. This idea of a dead matter that can be manipulated and changed and altered in a almost an alchemical way. And Newton himself was an alchemist, and yet he also understood that there is something, and there must always be something, that remains unchanging, even as the qualities of objects change over time. Or at least it's something that he developed later on in his career. As far as the Russian world is concerned, there is there are some writings out there that want to talk about a specifically Muscovite Baroque and then a so-called Petrine Baroque. But when you look at the examples of the Petrine Baroque that are out there, they're really not Baroque at all. If you look, for example, at the Kekin Hall, which is done in 1714, And it's that hall is there's pictures of it all over the place. That hall is done what looks to me very much in a neoclassic style. It is too much of this powerful facade. It's something that takes as much from the neoclassical tradition, or I really should say the tradition of the Roman Empire, as it does the Baroque. But Peter's political ideology was purely neoclassical. It was purely Roman. And I think that when you look at the ultimate example of the Kievan Baroque, or the Cossack Baroque, or the Mazeppa Baroque, the St. Michael's Monastery, the Golden Dome Monastery, I think there you see classic Ukrainian struggle with neo-national identity and personal freedom on the one hand, and the continuing encroachment of the state on the other. And I want to say that that is the ultimate example. It's the ultimate understanding of the Baroque period and the Baroque mentality, no matter where you might find it, but certainly in architecture and landscaping and also in painting as well. That ultimately the conclusion is the human will, the human intellect, human desire, and the desire to bring all of that under one roof, one singular purpose of roof, that is the ultimate core of the Baroque mentality. And what makes the Rococo so interesting, or the late Baroque so interesting, is that there is an attempt to find that kind of contentment, if not happiness, in the simplicity of a pristine nature where we can experience the processes of the Logos right in front of us, rather than in the artificial world of the Petersburgian bureaucracy. Anyway, I encourage you to find as many examples online as you can of these things, because it is striking, especially when you know what these people are trying to say. And although this is really an article or a talk, a lecture on Ukraine, you have to understand that the Baroque in general became a deep part of the Ukrainian struggle from Mazeppa and even before him all the way to the present day. And while it only touched Russia to a small extent, it became dominant in not just in Ukrainian, artifacts, but also in the Ukrainian mind as a whole, as something that makes Ukraine very different from Russia and a civilization in its own right. I thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
tuned into Radio